lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Oh, it's great to be back, Trey.
You know, when I do this show with Jay, and this is something that always got started back with Mike, you know, he's the defender of the Midwestern defender of freedom. I've always wondered, maybe, I mean, should we add to your title? I mean, could it be, you know, professor of law at Chase Law School and Midwestern socialist? Like, what would be your title?
let me think about that. I don't want to give one just off the top of my head and then be saddled with it forever. So by next show, I'll have one for you.
Fair. I feel you. Because I can imagine if you chose poorly, I would probably gravitate towards that. Well, we've got a really exciting Politics Guys show, Ken. So listeners, what we're going to start off with is we're going to get into the Friday morning acquittal of Rittenhouse. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about some questions that you all had on Discord about legal defense and defending, standing your ground. And then we're going to move on to the Bannon contempt case, which is something that Ken and I and Jay and I had talked about earlier, but we're going to get to come back to it now that we've got some charges going on there. That's going to be interesting. Likewise, on Friday, we had the Representative Gozar's the anime vote is what I'm going to call it. He was censured, and that's a big deal, moving him off of committees, and we'll have a chance to chat about that. Then we're going to talk a little bit more. I know that Jay and Mike last week got a chance to talk about the OSHA mandate and what the Fifth Circuit Court's opinion was, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that we've had more time to process through the opinion, and now that we know where it's headed. We'll also talk a little bit, because it's close to home to me, about that. In terms of what's happening with some of the states, specifically the Oklahoma National Guard and its relationship with the Pentagon. Now, we may or may not get the rest of these on here, but if we don't remember, if you are a subscriber to the show, you get access to our bonus show, which would include, for example, if we have time, the congressional estimates on the Build Back Better, specifically the difference between the CBO and Biden's position on that. We're also going to take a look at a couple of things close to home to me, specifically Julius Jones and Oklahoma Governor Stitt commuting his death sentence. We'll have a chance to talk about Ahmaud Arbery, who is the runner in Texas, who was shot and gunned down. Closing arguments are scheduled for Monday. It'll be a good chance for us to potentially talk about that, and then potentially some questions and others on the bonus show. So, Ken, we got a lot of things to cover. We'll see what we can get into this show. And again, if you are a supporter, you have an opportunity to get everything else in our simultaneously released bonus show. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to get into the Rittenhouse case. Okay, Ken, so early Friday morning, Rittenhouse was found not guilty on the fourth day of deliberation for the jury after a number of questions had come through. It seemed that one of the biggest things that jurors was interested in was watching the video evidence again now that they had the instructions in hand and not just during the case itself. The jury obviously has decided that Rittenhouse has acted in self-defense. Now, Rittenhouse has become a hero for many during doing what others were not willing, says the alt-right. He also became kind of a scapegoat for those on the left, as kind of being seen as the anti-BLM vigilante. Now, neither of these exactly seems to be the case, but his case is a difficult one, and not just for political reasons, but also because I think they point to some larger questions about gun laws and stand your ground law and what it means to be defending oneself. Now, before I get you to the full question, Ken, I want to put a couple of things out there. One is I'm just tired, and maybe you are too, I don't know, of those who support in Rittenhouse arguing that because the people who were shot had been convicted of a crime, or because they were just kind of, in their opinion, sleazy people, they deserve it, right? I mean, if you've been convicted of a crime, why can't we shoot you down on the street? I would like to start here by saying that, you know, living in a legal society, whether or not you think you have the right to defend yourself with a firearm, means that we do not, outside of some kind of extraordinary circumstances, get to make the decisions about justice. Justice comes through the legal system. I can just hear Ken through the microphone nodding his head. So if somebody does something evil and is punished for it via the legal system, then we can't forever be able to then say, hey, we can just shoot you without ramifications. And anybody who disagrees with me on that front, you are simply, I'm sorry, wrong. And I'm going to point you to John Locke on that front. Now, that said, all of this can really hinge on, does he act in self-defense? And so I want to bring up a few things. One is something that I didn't understand until I got into the weeds of this a little bit more. I thought that Rittenhouse had had a legal possession of a weapon, and apparently I was wrong on that front. Weirdly, long guns are allowable for 17-year-olds. In Wisconsin, minors can't possess short-barreled rifles, handguns, and short-barreled shotguns, although they can't purchase anything. And this actually goes back to a law in 1991. So as a result of this, those all got thrown out and that question came down to self-defense and things got pretty complicated. So Ken, I want to just start there. What do you think about the jury's decision? And let's just start there.
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying the issue about the 17-year-olds, because I actually didn't understand until you just said it why the judge had dismissed the weapons charge, because the prosecutor did get an indictment on a weapons charge, but then the judge dismissed it. And I guess that must be because of this issue about that this type of gun was permissible for a 17-year-old to own. So I hadn't fully known that before.
I didn't either. Yeah, it goes back to apparently thinking about gangs and things. Again, I don't know why they wrote the law the way that they did. But yeah, anybody can take a look at that 1991 law. I was unaware. But again, we're not experts in every state legal system, right?
So I did know that there had been an illegal weapons charge as part of the indictment, but that the judge had dismissed that before it ever got to the jury. Of the charges that got to the jury, I certainly would have hoped for a conviction on at least some of them. And in fact, when the jury took a few days to decide it, I wrongly had jumped to the conclusion during those few days that they were kind of trying to work out which one of the lesser charges they would actually convict him on. And, you know, because I had originally thought, well, if they're going to either acquit him or convict him on murder one, they'll probably get to that pretty quickly either way. And if it's more like if they have disagreements about what to convict him on, that would take days to work that out. But I was wrong about that. It must be my new sort of theory about why did it take a few days if they were going to acquit him on every count is they must have already been something like 10 to 2 or 11 to 1 from the get-go to acquit him on every count. And there may have been a few jurors who, you know, tried to hold out and see if they could change anybody else's mind, but eventually gave up on that. That would be my theory. I would be in the group that would consider this a miscarriage of justice, though. And I'll say, I don't know if he deserved to be convicted on the first degree reckless homicide that he was charged with, but at least on the lower counts that he was also charged with, like first degree recklessly endangering safety, first degree use of a dangerous weapon, even second degree, he could have been convicted on second degree on either of those two charges. There was also this very weird Wisconsin charge I hadn't heard of in other states, which is first degree. What do they call it? Intentional attempt, attempted intentional homicide, I guess. So there were a few different charges. With all those charges, I would think the jury should have convicted him on something, because I'm sure what he did was wrongful. And so without sort of trying to parse the nuances of which particular count did it fit, I would have sort of started with the principle it was wrong for him to kill these people. There was no reason for him to kill these people. And he went there, he crossed state state lines with a gun, looking for trouble. And he found the trouble he was looking for. And he was, you know, he was over there on kind of a murder safari to you know, look for some kind of situation that would let him murder some Black Lives Matter protesters. And I think he found what he was looking for. And that's kind of my take on the evidence. I will say, I don't think it's over yet, because there's two other kinds of legal proceedings that are still going to come, or at least one of them is still going to come. The criminal acquittal does not get him out of any civil liability, and I'm sure the victims' families will be suing. You know, you'll remember, for instance, O.J. Simpson got acquitted by a jury in a criminal case and still went through civil trials afterwards from the victims' families for wrongful death, where he was held liable. And I'm sure that's coming with Rittenhouse. The other one that may or may not be coming is, I guess, Congressman Nadler today called for the Justice Department to investigate civil rights violations. And it could certainly be a federal civil rights violation because he did cross state lines in this case, you know, arguably to go deprive people of their civil rights. And so it's hard to know what Merrick Garland will do about that. But the first calls have already come from Congress for Merrick Garland to look into a federal criminal prosecution there.
Well, a couple of things about that. One, I'm glad you bring up the difference between that, you know, the possibility he's still going to have civil complications. I think a lot of times, if listeners may or may not know, right, one of the big dividing lines in American legal system is between criminal cases, which is when you're being prosecuted for violating some particular statute, and civil cases when you're having an individual versus an individual with some kind of damages. And one of the key kind of procedural differences between those two areas of the legal system, of course, is for civil law, you don't have to have the same standard to be found liable, right? It's a lower standard to be found liable than it is to be found criminally prosecuted. Generally speaking, you need, I mean, you can correct me this one on Ken, but you know, it's beyond the shadow of a doubt you're going to have somebody who has done the particular statute violation where it's just the preponderance of evidence in the case of a civil case. Am I using that language right there?
Yeah, actually, beyond a reasonable doubt for a criminal, it's not quite shadow of a doubt.
I said shadow, and I didn't mean that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But preponderance of evidence is exactly right for a civil case, and other big differences might involve venue, because for a state criminal prosecution, that pretty much had to take place in Kenosha, where the crime took place, and so the jury you're getting is from Kenosha. For civil liability, if it's brought in a federal lawsuit, it would be brought in federal district court in Wisconsin, and that would be more likely to be in Madison or Milwaukee. So that would actually affect what kind of jury you might get as well.
Well, here's some things, you know, as you were kind of talking about. So that was the one side. But now on kind of the substantive thing, you know, I was looking into this a little bit more clearly. I was probably a little bit more sympathetic to your view earlier until I took a look a little bit more at what was going on in the trial. You know, so for example, I originally thought of him in the same way that you had categorized him there, Ken, you know, heading over across state lines. Of course, what I didn't realize was, of course, some of his family, in fact, lived there, and he had actually been there. So that kind of narrative of him crossing the state lines, I think, became a little bit more fuzzy. I can imagine that being part of the reason the jury took it the way that he did. As a matter of fact, he'd already been in the town doing things earlier that day. So, you know, that kind of initial narrative didn't seem to quite hold up in court. And I think the other piece for me, and this leads into some discord questions that I'd like us to get to, you know, when one of the victims was testifying, Groskowski, the one who was just injured and not killed, one of the things that comes out is that, at least in that particular encounter, Rittenhouse doesn't respond until he then has a gun pointed at him. As a matter of fact, the defense attorney asks him, quote, "It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, advanced on him with your gun, now your hands pointed at him, that he fired, right?" And Joseph responds, "Yeah, that's correct. It's not until I point at him." So I think part of this seems that, again, for me, I kind of saw this as a kid, A, who was illegally possessing a weapon, and I was wrong on that front, B, kind of heading across state lines just for trouble, which apparently is also a little more complicated than I thought. And then no matter what you think about the individual's who've been shot. I tried to make that really clear early on. I'm really kind of sick and tired of the, well, you know, this guy's a pedophile, so you just shoot him in the street anyway, or whatever. Whatever you think about any particular person is a load of malarkey. But that there's this kind of, as a matter of fact, maybe a more complicated encounter. So for me, I wondered if that wasn't necessarily was what was part of going on with the jury. And I thought, I was curious what you thought about that.
Yeah, you may be right. I mean, you know, the best thing we could, if we want to think well of a jury, and I think that's where you're going here, and it's certainly reasonable. If we want to put this in the best possible light and say that the jury was, you know, really just trying to follow the law and apply it to the facts as they saw it, you could argue that there was particularly under the Wisconsin law, which is a pretty lenient stand your ground law that allows people quickly to resort to shooting if they're threatened in some way, and the threat doesn't have to be a mortal threat. It just has to be some kind of threat of physical violence. So under that stand your ground law, Wisconsin allows people to, you can shoot somebody dead if they threatened you with physical violence, even if they didn't threaten you with deadly force. So if you think about that he had some reasonable basis for thinking that he was under some kind of threat, or at least there's enough doubt about whether his fear was reasonable or not that it doesn't meet the reasonable doubt standard. I think that is one way to look at this, is that the jury was just taking the reasonable doubt standard seriously, taking the fact that part of what's at issue here would be the defendant's state of mind, and there's always going to be some doubt about what he really thought in terms of how serious was the threat of physical violence and things like that. And so I don't think that it's impossible to construct a narrative where the jury did the right thing under the law. I guess I do think that's improbable, though. You know, I think it's to me, it doesn't seem like that really captures the story of what he was doing there at that protest with that gun.
Well, I think the other piece here, and I guess why I'm pushing on that particular narrative, Ken, and to talk about that more, is to say, in essence, I think one of the problems that we have is we have this kind of expectation of what we think the law ought to be. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? But then we don't always think about the practical implications of the law as it is, and therefore how it will play out. So for example, for me, you know, it's been a little over a year ago now. You know, I interviewed the author of Abolish the Second Amendment, and although I am a gun supporter, he swayed me on a number of ways. As a matter of fact, so much so that Mike actually did a response to be like, I think Trey was too easy on these anti-gun guys, right? Because I thought he made a very compelling case. But I couldn't help but see some of what's been happening when I'm looking at Rittenhouse more closely in terms of that book and thinking about those kinds of structural issues, to say that, you know, we have some of these laws the way we do. We bring up Stand Your Ground. And I think sometimes the idea of what they are and what they ought to be are at disconnect. And I think that leads to things like Rittenhouse. Do we really want to have, I mean, for example, Rittenhouse had the right to have that weapon. Do I really want 17-year-olds getting to be able to carry around weapons? Well, in an ought world, my answer is no, right? I don't want 17-year-olds getting to make those kinds of split-second decisions. I know some of what your feelings on that are, but yeah, well, I'm curious. So,
you and I talked about this actually last time when we were talking about stand your ground laws, and we even talked about my student who was shot dead by someone exercising.
Yes, I was thinking about that.
Yeah. I blame the legal framework in Wisconsin probably more than I blame the particular jury. So, if to the extent that I think there's an injustice here, which I really do, I think the injustice begins with the fact that the law, first of all, does allow open carriage, you know, even into volatile situations. And then it does allow this stand your ground law where you've got a bunch of people who have a legal privilege to carry their guns into volatile subtle situations where there can be expected to be confrontations. And then they've also got the right, if they have some reason to feel threatened, to shoot somebody else. So a legal framework like that is kind of, it's creating a great opportunity for situations like this. And so if the jury looks at that and says, well, that's the law that they've got, and so that's the law we've got to apply, I think that's reasonable. But I would still say it seems to me like there's been a great injustice nonetheless. And I also think that the jury had room to interpret the law differently. Right. So I think they had a range of ways they could interpret what was going on here. And so even though I think it's possible that they could say, well, he had a right to open carry, he had a stand your ground law, he had a right to shoot somebody if he felt threatened by that person, he had some reason to feel threatened by that person. I still think with that same legal framework, they could say, well, he really had no reason to feel threatened by that person. And he really did create the incident that then caused him to have to stand his ground. And I don't think they were required to acquit him. I'll just put it that way.
Well, I will say, and then I want to kind of get to this question, again, I didn't recognize that he had also been confronted with weapons. And so on the front, and again, we can't say that all the way across the board for all of our victims, but of course that's the way it gets grouped into those charges. That does, at least in the framework of law that they have in Wisconsin, change it a little bit for me to say, well, recognizing that your open carry could cause others to think of you as being an active shooter, since you're able to do that, doesn't mitigate then you pointing a weapon at me, which I think is part of that confrontation. But now this leads us into a question then, Ken. One of our amazing supporters and executive producer, supporter level specifically, Andra, she had this really detailed question on Discord. And I thought we should take this on. She had originally taken it at Mike and Jay. She's like, no, but what about Trey and Ken? And I thought, of course, we're better. No, I'm just So I want to read. It's a little bit longer, but I'm gonna read this question. And she writes, I have a question regarding self-defense and the Second Amendment in court. In a discussion about Kyle Rittenhouse's claim that he feared his aggressors would take his weapon, John Dickerson made the comment that it's almost self-exculpating. You can, by carrying a gun, always claim it might be taken away from you. The point, of course, is that a person can always make a self-defense claim that they fired in fear for their life because an attacker might take their firearm and therefore effectively be using legal force. So no matter what you do, every confrontation, Andra's saying, could be seen in that front. So how valid is that view of Dickerson, Ken? What do you think? So do you think that this kind of defense succeeds in a lot of cases? Andra wants to know. And are you familiar with any other cases that might be precedent? It's really interesting to her, and she'd like to really hear that. And it really gets to what we're talking about here, right? So if you can open carry in states that have that, and at the same time you have a stand your ground where just fearing someone might take your weapon is a valid excuse to shoot, wouldn't that always be a valid excuse, or no? And what's the precedent there?
Well, see, precedents are tricky in this area for a couple reasons. Both open carry laws and stand your ground laws are relatively new. And so the country really didn't have either until just a couple years ago. And when we use the word self-defense, self-defense has a completely different meaning in a stand your ground jurisdiction than in any other jurisdiction, because the stand your ground laws, in essence, amend the self-defense provisions of criminal codes. If we're talking about traditional self-defense in a non-stand your ground jurisdiction, there would have to be one would have to be trying to protect oneself or others from the use of deadly force, right? So protecting property would never justify killing somebody. Even protecting someone from a non-deadly use of force, use of non-deadly force wouldn't justify killing somebody. And if there's no stand your ground law, there's always a duty to retreat. So if you have the ability to get away, then it's never justified to use deadly force in traditional self-defense. So the stand your ground underground laws reverse a lot of that. They change the law of self-defense and give it, they sort of put it on steroids, you know, and they say, well, now not only can you use deadly force to defend yourself or someone else against deadly force, but you can use it to defend your property. You can use it to defend yourself against non-deadly force. And you don't have to retreat, even if you could retreat. So if you imagine a situation like where, you know, you're standing in an open doorway and you see somebody with a gun, well, in many jurisdictions, you could just go inside the building and shut the door. And that would be a reasonably safe way of, of defending yourself. But in a stand your ground jurisdiction, you'd be under no obligation to do that. You could just you could shoot the person, even if you could just walk into the building and shut the door. And so there's so little experience with the application of these kinds of laws. These are new laws. And the prevalence of open carry is pretty new also. So I think these are questions that are going to be getting worked out, you know, jury by jury at first. And then, you know, really the binding law comes from appellate courts, but you don't even get to an appeal unless people actually get convicted. So like a case like Rittenhouse case where he got acquitted, it's not going to really even produce an appellate court opinion that's going to really clarify what the limits are, because the jury doesn't write an opinion when they issue their verdict and nobody can appeal it.
Well, and the other piece I'd like to add there is we oftentimes think about the American system as having a singular legal system. But of course, in these kinds of criminal proceedings, that's really the purview of states. And so each state can have vastly different kinds of even stand your ground. So one of the things that I was looking at in response to Andra's question was, you know, I've lived in two states now with stand your ground laws. Florida and now Oklahoma. But Oklahoma actually has a far less that's not even the right word. It has a less structured stand your ground in the sense that not as many things apply. So in Florida, for example, even in the midst of other kinds of illegal activity, there's a case where there's a drug deal going down and one person feels unsafe about the other person, shoots them. And originally, prosecutors still wanted to take the case forward, but the argument there was under the law, well, it doesn't matter. Even if you're doing illegal things, that doesn't void your stand your ground right. Whereas in Oklahoma, it depends on your location. So, for example, if I have a weapon in downtown Oklahoma City, I don't have the right to remain where I am and engage because the law only accounts to private places where I have kind of the right to exclusively be there. So, you know, if I'm at home, is one of the examples in the Oklahoma law, and somebody is trying to get into my house, I don't have to retreat, kind of in the situation that you're talking about. But if I'm at this grocery store, I do. So that's a really different kind of scenario than the stand your ground in Florida. So I think part of it is you have to think about this as being a federal difference. Again, I'm not taking a side on which of these is right or better.
Right.
Just you have to think about that when you're thinking about trying to understand our legal system.
Yeah, those stand your ground laws that limit the duty to retreat goes away only in one's home and not elsewhere. They sometimes call that the castle doctrine, based on the idea that a man's home is his castle, and I guess a woman's home too. But yeah, so there's just a lot of variation here and a lot of novel issues being worked out. You know, I think there will be a lot of cases because I don't think there's anything very unique about this Rittenhouse case. I think we're going to see a lot more situations like this and a lot more criminal charges brought, and we'll really end up seeing how courts are working it out. And I imagine we'll probably wind up seeing some different approaches in some different states as well.
Yeah. And I think the last bit is to remember, you know, Andra, that not many states, even among those who have stand your ground, also have open carry. So, for example, neither Florida nor Oklahoma have open carry, but Wisconsin and Kentucky, to my knowledge, both do.
Yeah, they do.
And that actually radically changes. Like, so in the case of what was happening with Rittenhouse, I can imagine a very different scenario if one's gun must be concealed until they're right, because in this case nobody would have thought of anybody else as being potentially a threat because no one would have known if somebody was armed. And so again, you have that's another bit of the law there that's different. And I haven't done a study, so I don't know how many states have open carry, but it doesn't appear that it's as many as they have stand your ground.
Ohio now has both. We have open carry and stand your ground. And I have seen people open carrying around in Cincinnati. So, it's all recent. One other thing I would say before I forget on Andre's question, even though I was just talking about how diverse all these laws and how informed they all are, one thing I would say is, even under the most permissive stand your ground laws that let people do the most shooting to defend their ground, they always have to have a reason. So they can't just say, I felt scared. They're going to have to say they had some reason that they felt scared. So if you're talking about that hypothetical you gave where, well, I'm carrying a gun and I see somebody else, and for all I know, they're going to try to take away my gun, so therefore I better shoot them first. you're going to have to, someone who does that, even under the most permissive stand your ground law, is going to have to be able to articulate a reason why they believed that the other person was going to try to take away their gun and shoot them with it. And if it's just, well, he looked like the kind of person who might, that probably isn't going to be good enough. There's probably going to have to be some kind of reason that's articulable of, he was, moving right towards it. And he said, I'm taking your gun, something like that. Right. And really, that is the kind of issue that I'm talking about in the Rittenhouse case. When I say I wouldn't have voted the way the jury voted, I don't really believe that he had reason to believe that he was defending himself against violence or someone else against violence. But that's the kind of thing that a jury would have to find on particular facts.
Yeah. Well, Ken, I think what we should do is probably take a brief break, and when we come back, talk about the Bannon contempt case. It's an episode full of law.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back and take a look at Bannon's contempt case. Well, Ken, last Friday, Bannon was indicted by a federal grand jury on 2 counts of contempt of Congress. And it went back, as a matter of fact, to kind of a virtual argument that we had. I should say maybe you and Jay had via me. As I'm going to kind of remind listeners, because all the show's hosts have been kind of weighing in on this one, Jay has argued that Congress shouldn't have the power to truly compel individuals to appear, the statutes notwithstanding, that you must comply. And further, it was nothing but a show anyway, what was happening in Congress, because we already had impeachment hearings. Anything that was going to come out should have come out then. On the other hand, Ken, you argued, and as a matter of fact, quoted the statute, that it does indeed apply. And further, that Congress needs to have that kind of power if it's going to meaningfully have any kind of oversight. So, in a move that some see as being nothing more than show and others see as being a potential for there to be teeth to congressional subpoenas, Steve Bannon was indicted by a federal grand jury for defying a subpoena. Now, at the initial hearing, which happened this week, Bannon's lawyers were clearly looking to push back the date and kind of stonewall. I would argue that this was all about trying to stonewall. Listening to it, I couldn't help but laugh a little bit, Ken. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this. One of the things that Bannon's lawyers argued was that, look, oh, dear judge, I know you're busy dealing with more important matters, like the January 6th cases. And I thought, what a terrible argument to make. Right. Like, I mean, Bannon, fire them. I mean, yeah. Ken Katkin, well, yeah, he will take up, right, the, I mean, for enough money. No, I'm just
yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the January 6th cases, of course.
Exactly. But of course, this idea that they're trying to separate it in terms of that, this procedural hearing, which is, I always find it, listeners, it's always interesting to me to take a look at those procedural cases. You can learn a lot sometimes. The judge, however, wasn't willing to push it too far back. The next step takes place in early December now. But as of right now, this may just be ending up running out the clock as we move up against the midterm elections. And as has been pointed out by a number of outlets, there are 35 other people connected to the Trump administration, the Stop the Steal organization, or overlapping between the both, who have stonewalled and have yet now to be indicted. So you argued that they ought to do this. You argued that the Justice Department should do this. They did. What do you think happens next, Ken?
Well, I think they'll probably try the case, by the summer, I suppose. I don't think it'll be, just tried tomorrow or anything. But I think the judge is going to try to keep it moving, on an ordinary calendar. And Bannon will keep trying to delay it. And he'll probably come up with a few ways to delay it for a week here and a week there. But I think he's going to get convicted. And I think he's going to go to prison. And in fact, I'll predict that he's going to go to prison for significantly longer than the criminal sentence will be for, because I don't think the criminal sentence will be for more than a few months, but it'll make it much, much easier for the Congress to seek civil contempt against him as well as criminal contempt. So civil contempt would be that Congress would just sue him directly and say to a judge, he still hasn't testified in Congress and he still hasn't produced the documents that we asked for. And so can you just hold him in jail as a means of coercing compliance? And
I was
going
to ask, I wanted to ask specifically about that. And then I want you to continue because this is one of the things that was on my radar. So again, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but in a traditional contempt, right? Even once you've served the time, if you don't comply, then you can continue to be held in contempt, right?
Yeah.
Now, as I look at the statute, it doesn't seem to be written like other contempt. So is that a possibility? No. And what would that look like?
Yeah.
You were getting into that, but I was curious because compare,
Right. So there's civil contempt and there's criminal contempt. So it's more unusual for a person to be charged with the crime of contempt of Congress, as Steve Bannon has. It's more usual for people to be charged in a civil lawsuit with civil contempt. So there's the differences are if he's convicted of this crime, for instance, and sentenced to a few months in jail, well, even if he then says, OK, I'll talk, that's not going to get him out of those few months in jail. He's going to have to serve his sentence. And he's also going to have a criminal record so that if he gets convicted again of another crime, he's not a first offender anymore. So under the sentencing guidelines, that's going to give him a much heavier sentence. And I suppose, well, this is probably of limited relevance to Steve Bannon, but for some people, having a criminal record would have caused them other kinds of problems. Like it would make it hard for them to pass a background check that might be needed for certain kinds of jobs and things like that, or to get a mortgage or something like that.
So do you think that like Lindell would stop speaking with him?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, for him, none of that's going to matter. But the one thing that will matter is if he gets convicted of another crime, the sentencing guidelines take heavy account of whether someone's a first offender or not. And so if he's already got a criminal record, that's a big deal. So civil contempt, which is more typical, arises when instead of trying to get a criminal prosecution, civil litigants will say to a judge, look, I'm entitled to hear from this witness or to get these materials from this witness, and they haven't coughed them up. Will you find that they're in civil contempt, which doesn't involve any prosecution? It doesn't involve any allegation of crime. It's just a purely coercive method to try to get the litigant or the witness to comply with a subpoena. And then the civil contempt can lead to incarceration until the person complies. And you might remember in the original Whitewater investigations of President Clinton, before they kind of morphed into the Monica Lewinsky investigations, there were some business partners of the Clintons in the Whitewater real estate investment, a couple named the McDougals, Jim and Susan McDougal. And Susan McDougal was held in civil contempt because she wouldn't respond to Ken Starr's subpoenas in the Whitewater matter. And she was never charged with a crime, but she spent more than 2 years in jail. Because, on any day she could have got out of jail by just saying, OK, I'll testify and I'll give up the documents. But she didn't do that. And she spent more than 2 years in jail. And I definitely do foresee a situation like that happening with Bannon. It'll actually be much easier to get the civil contempt if he's already been convicted of criminal contempt. And I don't think that, at least as long as the Dems control the House committee, and I suppose that could end in 2023, but at least as long as the Dems control the House committee and there is the January 6th committee and all this, and they want compliance, I think they're going to have the ability to get a civil contempt against him and get him incarcerated. And again, I think that's going to greatly exceed the length of the criminal sentence that'll be doled out in the criminal case.
Now, as I mentioned, you know, we have 35 other individuals who are making these similar kinds of claims. And again, the fundamental claim ranges from, I don't have to appear before the committee, which is, we've already dealt with that. The other element here that Bannon and others are advancing or have advanced, again, not in a, in a completely legal venue yet, is that effectively the president has the ability to keep information from Congress using executive privilege. Now, in this instance, President Biden has not agreed to do that, which is generally the way it works. Former presidents kind of defer to the current president when it comes that way. There has been no such deferral in the case of Trump. But additionally, the argument of this privilege is extending beyond, right? So, for example, Bannon is a great test example of this because he was not, in fact, part of the administration in the time leading up, nor during the time for which there is being requests by Congress. So I guess my other question is do we only see this with Bannon, or do you think more tests, individuals who fall into different categories, are going to come from the Justice Department as well eventually? In other words, so here we have Bannon, an individual who was not in it, because that's going to be a different than, say, somebody who had been in it and left, or who was in it. But, you know, the Biden administration is saying you can go ahead and have the have these documents. What do you think happens on that front? Or do you think it's just all going to center around Bannon?
No, I think there's going to be some other criminal indictments besides Bannon. But I think the reason that the criminal indictments started with Bannon is because his claim of executive privilege is frivolous, right? Whereas in some of the other claims, you could say, well, there's no precedent for a claim like that, but they're at least arguable within the framework of Supreme Court cases that talk about executive privilege. But it's a stretch to argue that a former president could assert executive privilege against the wishes of a current president. Mm-hmm. It's arguable, but it's a stretch. But I'd say it's not even arguable that someone who was not a member of the administration that there could ever be any executive privilege in a case like that. There's no theory that could support that. There's no suggestions of anything like that in any case that's ever discussed executive privilege. And all of the underpinnings of the doctrine of executive privilege are really linked to the idea that it's members of the administration, that the president. The leading case on this is actually still the United States versus Nixon case from the Watergate tapes mm-hmm. subpoena. And that's a unanimous case of the Supreme Court, where they give a very detailed explanation of the scope of executive privilege. And you know, it's a case where they recognize that there is executive privilege, but they also put limits on it and ultimately find that Nixon couldn't properly claim it when he didn't want to turn over the Watergate tapes. But what they say about it is the reason for executive privilege, it's kind of analogized to something like attorney-client privilege or spousal privilege or priest-penitent privilege. There's all these privileges in the law of evidence where the law of evidence holds that even though generally in litigation, mechanisms like discovery or subpoenas are available, or document production requests are available because of the truth-seeking function of litigation, that litigation is sort of primarily about the court being able to figure out the truth. And so all of these mechanisms to sort of force the other side to give up information enhances truth-seeking. But then we have some privileges in the law of evidence where sometimes certain requests for the content of communications can be resisted. So the classic one would be the attorney-client privilege, where, you know, if I'm litigating against someone, maybe I'd like to subpoena that person's lawyer and say, tell me what your client told you about this case. You know, that might be very, very truth enhancing for me to find out the truth. But the courts have always said, and in fact, the federal rules of evidence, which are a federal statute, also say, even though that might be truth enhancing, there's a stronger public policy against requiring that kind of communication to be disclosed, because people wouldn't be able to tell the truth to their lawyers about anything if they thought that their lawyers would have to turn over what they said. And if people couldn't tell the truth to their lawyers, the lawyers wouldn't be able to prepare the cases properly, and the whole adversarial system would come crashing down. And so it would ultimately be truth defeating, not truth enhancing. And so with that kind of framework, the Nixon court says, well, it's similar for the president. If the president president has to make decisions in the public interest for the country. If there's sometimes, you know, he's got to make hard choices, and there's difficult situations, and no choice is a great choice, but the president's got to do things. Then what he needs to be able to do is, you know, get his top deputies, his cabinet, his administration, his inner circle of advisors who are part of his administration, you know, into the Oval Office, and they can have a full and frank discussion, and they can consider all the options, and that, and then he can be fully informed and make the best decisions. And that wouldn't be possible if he couldn't have a full and frank discussion with his own cabinet members who have the relevant information and whose job is dealing with the problems that the president ultimately has to make the decision on. So that kind of justification, you know, it doesn't even apply to people who aren't part of the administration, right? He's got to be able to talk to his national security advisor to make a national security decision. He's got to be able to talk to his domestic policy advisor, you know, to make a decision about, you know, how to fund the Build Back Better bill or something. But he doesn't need to be able to talk to people who aren't part of his administration, and it's not part of their job to help him make these decisions. And so there's nothing in any of the theoretical underpinnings of the executive privilege doctrine that would say it could ever apply to someone who's not actually part of the president's administration. And there's never been a claim before that it could. So that's why I think, you know, Bannon's invocation of that doctrine is so frivolous that it's easy. I think it's going to be easy to prove that he's just intentionally obstructing Congress. And I do think there's others like that. In fact, paradoxically, I think Mark Meadows, who his job was chief of staff, and I think as chief of staff, you know, he's well positioned for there to be a more legitimate claim of executive privilege. But yet, I think he'll be indicted, because I think the thing is, he's not making those claims, right? If he was going to make a legitimate claim of executive privilege, he would actually have his lawyers submit briefs to the Congress in response to the subpoenas and say, well, here's our argument for why the documents that you've requested are privileged, right? And if he would do something like that, I think he'd be kind of bulletproof on any criminal charges, because he's got the right to make good faith arguments. But if he's just, you know, not just saying, I'm just not going to participate, I'm not going to respond, I think that shows a similar kind of willful obstruction that's going to get him indicted.
Yeah, I'm happy that you went back to the Nixon case. I thought that was the most recent precedent, but, you know, I'm not a lawyer. And in that framework, as you point out, I don't know how you even come up with anything like Bannon. And I guess the best that I can say from this case, from my point of view as a political scientist, is it feels a little bit like the episode of The Office where Michael recognizes that, you know, he's spending more than he's making, and he's declared bankruptcy, and he walks out into the office and says, "I declare bankruptcy," right? I feel like Trump is like, "I declare presidential privilege," right? I don't think he really has any clue what that really is that there's any kind of concept of it. Now, Bannon probably does know better, but he probably ends up winning politically by spending some time in jail.
I think that's what he thinks. And he knows the sentence on the criminal contempt charge is a very short sentence anyhow.
And worst case scenario, he's out in 23.
Yeah, for civil contempt. But I think for the criminal contempt, if he actually gets convicted, my prediction will be he'd get 3 months or maybe 4 months sentence.
Okay.
But yeah, not more than that. So the criminal contempt has a maximum sentence of a year, but he's a guy who's got no criminal record because he was pardoned on his other charges, and who you know, it's a first offense. It's a white collar crime. It's a, you know, I think the sentencing guidelines, if you just run them, they would end up putting someone like him in at 3 months probably. So nobody has sought civil contempt yet. They've only sought the criminal conviction for criminal contempt. So if he is convicted in this proceeding, he's just going to get a criminal sentence, and that's going to be a short sentence.
Well, I think what we're going to need to do, Ken, is take a brief break, come back, and get in one more story on Representative Gussar. Well, Ken, I am going to say something as we come back out of here at a break that, you know, this might be unpopular. This is unpopular, but I think it's something that all of my students know. And I don't know if you know this about me. I am not an anime fan. This is coming out. Now, and it's weird because a lot of people think that I must be, right? I'm a longtime proponent that of the art of video games and of their cultural relevance. And I mean that quite seriously. So I know, I think a lot of people are surprised when I'm not as big of an anime fan. Now, you know, as a libertarian-leaning guy, I do want to put it out there. I am more than willing for people to watch subpar programming like anime. I mean, that's fine. but weirdly, we're going to have to talk a little bit about this because it is at the center of a censure vote in Congress. This past week, Representative Gosar's staff posted a video from the anime Attack on Titan, where his face is superimposed over the central character's face in the intro to this show, in which he then kills a character who has been, the giant's face has been superimposed with Representative Ocasio-Cortez's face, and then moves on to fight Bannon with knives. Now, again, originally he took the representative took the video down after the backlash, which then this week has led to his censure, mostly along party lines today on Friday, which of course removes him from any of his committee seat appointments. In response to that vote, though, he apparently reposted the video, although I have not able to get my hands on it. It has either been taken down by social media, or he took it down again. Newsweek and a number of others argued that he had put it up. I can't find it, and I can't even find the original, which makes me think maybe it's gotten deplatformed for other reasons. In response on Friday to the censure vote, he said, quote, that the censure vote was, quote, over a cartoon my staff posted last week depicting the real-life battle taking place along our southern border, resulting from Mr. Biden's open border policy, end quote. Now, I didn't know about this, so I did some hard work for us, Ken. Attack on a Titan is actually a show about giants that come and they consume humans, and they don't consume them to eat them so much, although they are eating them, but they're consuming them kind of for pleasure. And so what humans do, get ready for this to be right on the nose, they build a giant wall to protect humanities from the giants. So the giants can't get over this extra giant, giant-proof wall, and humans then live in behind walls. Until one day, an extra colossus giant that's bigger than the wall breaks the wall down and kills the protagonist's mother. And so then as a result, the main character is starting the beginning of the show off after all this happens, vowing to finally be the hunter who's going to kill all of the giants. And so the intro video is kind of all of this getting ready to kill things. We got to kill things because they're breaking down humanity in the wall. So again, kind of on the nose, he called other members a, quote, a mob of censors. As a matter of fact, in the vote for censure, only Representatives Cheney and Kingsizer voted in favor. He issued a statement yesterday prior to the censure, as a matter of fact, comparing his plight to those that were murdered in the 2015 in Paris. I don't know if you remember this. A newspaper published images of the Prophet Muhammad, and it led some radicals to stabbing and killing individuals there in France. And he said this, quote, I remind everyone that pretending to be upset over a cartoon and wanting to suppress the ideas in a cartoon is what happened to the Charlie Hebdo magazine in France. All right-thinking people condemned that then, and they should condemn the Democrats now for their violation of free speech, end quote. So what do you think about the censure, about the video? Again, I don't know if you got a chance to watch it. I never was able to. And what do you think this kind of says about, well, I mean, decorum and conversation in Congress?
Yeah, I never even looked for the video, so I have not watched it or tried to watch it. But I liked the almost absurdness of his free speech argument. He's comparing the fact that other people are criticizing him, which one might think is their free speech, to they're killing him. Like, he's literally comparing that to, it's the same thing for someone to criticize him as for people to murder him, right? You know, with no awareness that, you know, other people have free speech also, and that includes the right to criticize him, which is quite different than the right to murder him, which nobody has done or tried to do. But he's the one who's called for murders. You know, congressional censure is a purely political proceeding. In more recent years, they generally don't do it on these kind of party line votes. I was looking through the list. There's sort of three different proceedings that Congress can use to represent, to express disapproval of a member. The strongest one is expulsion. They can expel members. That doesn't happen that often, but it has happened. In recent times, Congressman Traficant from here in Ohio was kicked right out of the Congress for bribery and obstruction of justice. In 2002, Congressman Myers was kicked out in 1980. Those are a couple of the more recent cases. Those were both by overwhelming votes, and it requires a two-thirds vote to expel somebody. They have censure, and then they also have the lesser version of that, which is reprimand. So Congress can vote to censure or to reprimand a member. It only takes a simple majority vote to do that. There's no actual consequences of it, and the only real difference between censure and reprimand is that censure is considered stronger than reprimand. But as I was looking at modern time,
it also, the difference between those two, I believe, for the censure, you lose all of your committee posts.
No, they actually had to vote that separately. That's not part of the censure.
Oh, I take that back then. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, so they could censure him and not take away his committee posts. Or, in fact, as they did with Marjorie Taylor Greene, they took away her committee posts, but they never censured her. Those are actually separate votes, although with Gosar, they did both.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Marjorie Taylor Greene did lose her committee post, but was never censored. The previous censure vote actually happened to my one-time congressman. So Charlie Rangel, who represented the District of New York City that I used to live in, was censored in 2010, and that's the last time anyone was censored. And that was by a vote of 333-79, and he was censored for misuse of congressional letterhead for fundraising, impermissible use of a rent-controlled facility for campaign headquarters, and inaccurate financial reports and federal tax returns. So that was a 333-79. That's a pretty lopsided vote, but the censures before that were even more lopsided. So if you look at, there were a spate of censures in the 1970s and 80s, and I think the closest vote in the 80s was 421-3, and some of the votes were unanimous or even were voice votes. So it's only really more recently, I guess, that we're moving towards these more party line censor votes. It was, if you look at the relatively recent 20th century history, it's usually by unanimous or near unanimous majorities. So it's usually was happening when parties were not sticking by their own members. But I don't know if that's possible anymore. I mean, it seems to me that this should have been unanimous. And, I think the conduct here was worse than the conduct in many of the unanimous censure votes. So I think that's just the world we're living in now.
I've been thinking about this, and I guess one of the reasons it made it difficult, and I recognize why some may want to not consume that particular content, but as a scholar and as somebody who, you want to do the show, I generally want to be talking about the thing that I viewed rather than, second and third hand. Again, that's why I watched the intro and the subtitles and, got more of the other sense of the show. And I think one of the things that highlights here, maybe it doesn't answer the question of whether or not he ought to be censored, because I'm not that maybe, is that I think there's a little bit of a paradox in that we're living in a world that is dominated by communication via memes and video memes. And often I think there's some of us who would argue that we ought to be better than that in certain ways. But Congress, because it's an expression of more and more average kinds of individual, or at least a cross sample of individuals, not necessarily the median person, of course, that they're going to communicate in those kinds of ways too. And so while the kind of the message behind it is probably not the best one, and it's not going to build positive relationships, it certainly is the way that I think a lot of people communicate. And so I wonder if this ends up just kind of, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is that I find these kinds of memes, even outside of Congress, to be a bad way of communicating. But given that we've kind of accepted this is the way that we communicate, it's not shocking to me that we have now seen it appear in congressional discourse, because it's a reflection of the people who put them there. And I can't imagine it's going to go away anytime soon. I don't see the meme being a style, even ones that are making particularly, I think, poor points about immigration and untrue. I mean, again, you know, Biden does not in any stretch of the imagination have an open borders policy.
Yeah, I think the thing is, though, I'm very much for free speech also, but I would not think of this as a freedom of speech issue, because he's a member of Congress and he's specifically not talking about a policy issue like immigration. He's actually talking about communicating a threat against another Congress member. And the Congress has standing rules that prohibit that kind of thing. They, in fact, have standing rules that even prohibit name calling of another. You know, yes. they have to address each other respectfully, and they can certainly, you know, be very they can have a lot of invective when they're talking about policy issues or even you know, actions. I mean, like you saw Congressman McCarthy's 8-hour speech last night,
something which we'll like talk about later in the bonus show.
Yeah, an 8-hour screed against everything the Biden administration has done. But I think that doesn't cross the line, because he limited it to, you know, just criticizing all the things that the Biden administration has done, but not name calling, not calling anybody a bunch of names, and not threatening violence against anybody. Mm-hmm. And I think for a collegial body to operate, especially a collegial body where you've got, you know, a lot of partisanship and, you know, a lot of passion and emotion, really, you know, it just can't function if it just degenerates into a bar brawl. And I think the body needs to maintain rules of decorum, and always has maintained these rules of decorum, and has censored in the past for breaches that were much less severe than this one, and censored on unanimous or near unanimous votes for breaches that were much less significant than this one, because it's essential to the functioning of what still has to function as a collegial body, that decorum is maintained. I don't see how they could function otherwise. I mean, just think even about faculty meetings. You know, sometimes people do cross these lines at faculty meetings, but if people were really just starting to threaten to kill each other and calling each other all kinds of names and cuss words and things, you know, nothing could get done. And members should not have the ability to bring the United States Congress to a standstill by, you know, breaching decorum to such an extent that it renders the whole body dysfunctional.
Now, I completely agree with how you laid it out. I guess I don't have a position yet. I'm still trying to sort this out. But to kind of take your analogy about the faculty body is to suggest, though, okay, so we have those kinds of decorums and we do it in the faculty meetings. But I would be shocked if individuals are not, well, as a matter of fact, I know they do. I mean, it all of our institutions. Maybe not. Maybe I'm curious about Chase. Maybe not. I don't know. But I can imagine oftentimes what is said in social media positions is different, and probably at a different kind of standard than what one would do in those kinds of formal interactions and gatherings. And I think one of the things that makes Congress difficult is it is. Those two obviously bleed into one another, but whereas for the faculty, it's probably a little bit clear cut because you don't have this secondary audience to, you know, faculty members aren't trying to get the support of their communities behind their positions in the same way, in other words, to try against another faculty member. And so I hear what you're saying there, and you make a case, but I think that's what, for me, that's that next layer that complicates it, right? So had he, you know, you're walking around the Congress and you're like, hey, I'm going to cut you down in the way that his meme clearly says or demonstrates, I get that. But then you have this like, I'm cutting you down to get to this. I mean, again, I don't agree with any of his positions on the border.
Yeah.
But what do we do with these kinds of social media? I you make a compelling point, I'm saying, Ken, but I'm just still trying to tuss out how to think about it in terms in those platforms, I guess.
So you're saying there is a line between maintaining decorum inside the Capitol building and maintaining decorum in social media. And you're saying it might be fair to expect them to maintain the decorum inside the Capitol building, but not to hold them to the same people to that same standard when they're on social media.
Especially when they're trying to communicate potentially with their supporters and or their voters. Now, again, maybe I'm not suggesting that is what ought to happen, but that's at least that's where I'm wondering if your analogy continues to move forward.
Well, I guess I see the point, but what I would say to it is I think for Congress, it amounts to the same thing because they for one thing, the things they say in social media, as we saw on January 6th, can have a direct impact on the ability of the Congress to function, right? Mm. They got big platforms, they got large audiences, and if they create the idea out there on social media that the members of the other party are actually you know, criminal villain pedophiles who need to be killed, you know, that's been proven that can have a serious impact on the ability of the Congress to function. And I think also members of Congress, I think the principle here is they have to accept the standards of operating within a collegial body, which doesn't at all require them to censor their opinions. But I really think threats and invective and name calling shouldn't be labeled as opinions, right? It doesn't contribute anything to the advancement of any kind of arguments or opinions to just, you know, threaten to kill the other members or call the other members' names or to use another censor case which did happen. You remember when Congressman Wilson yelled, "You lie," in the middle of President Obama's State of the Union. And that led to actually that was only a reprimand vote, not a censor vote, but that was Congressman Joe Wilson in 2009. And, you know, again, breaching decorum like that, it doesn't advance ideas. And I think when they're talking, they have plenty of opportunity, you know, on the floor of the Congress in speeches and debates or, you know, to media audiences to take very hard hitting views, critical of positions advanced by the other party or critical of actions taken by members of the other party. But I don't see that any of that is advanced at all by, you know, raising the temperature level to the point of trying to incite threats of violence against the other party. It just makes it not consistent with the idea of a functioning deliberative body.
Yeah, I mean, that's a compelling point, Ken. That really is. You know, I think the last thing I want to say, and then we're going to have to, I think, put the rest of the things on the bonus show, is to say that the one bit here that continually amuses me, well, maybe amuses the wrong word, but amuses me, is the idea that in a marketplace of ideas, even if you have something inflammatory to say, that if other people find your inflammatory thing to be terrible, that somehow them commenting on your terribleness, that you've been violated your right to speak or that you're being suppressed. Or in some way, you know, I mean, even if you take that view, even if you're going to take the view that his meme reaches to that, certainly he is in no way suffered from others saying, look, you're a terrible, despicable human being as a result of communicating in this way, or, you know, this point is wrong. And I see that to be an increasing position from many in this kind of emergent portion of the right, this idea that free speech means I get to say what I want to say and you can't criticize it.
Right. There's a great book of free speech, like of dust ups, just of conflicts that have arisen in history over freedom of speech. And it was written by a writer named Nat Hentoff, who was a journalist. He used to write for the Village Voice in New York City, and he just collected a lot of these stories. And the name of the book is Free Speech for Me, but Not for Thee. And I think that sort of encapsulates the idea that you're getting at here.
So free speech for me, not for thee. Okay, we had a book recommendation in the show as well.
I'm actually going to take a look.
You know, this was graduation today for me, so I have more time. I'm going to take a look at that. Well, Ken, it has been a lot of fun doing the show with you. We didn't get to nearly everything, which means, of course, that we're going to finish this. And then in just a few minutes, we'll start recording again and take on all the stories that we were able to get to on our simultaneously released bonus show. So I'll see you again in just a few moments. But in the meantime, I just want to thank listeners for listening to The Politics Guys. I have this little spiel that I do at the end of the show. I think sometimes it might sound like, well, that's just trite. That's just what he says. But I truly mean doing the show is wonderful. And having people who are so passionate about learning and understanding on these policy positions and to be able to talk and have a back and forth with Ken, just even as I'm trying to think through some of these things myself, I love listening to his point, especially when I haven't always, even necessarily formulated what it is that's right. And I think that's the way that you do it is you listen to other people's positions and you get in there and you think about things and you change. And I think that's what's not only just so neat about The Politics Guys, but about all of you who listen. You want to be a part of that. And so thank you for subscribing to the show. And if you haven't already, of course, subscribe to the show on the podcast app of your choice. If there's episodes that are particularly meaningful for you, we'd love for you to share them on social media. Share something better than people killing giants with AOC's face on it, right? This is what we need. We also, of course, need your financial support. And that's just part of the nature of doing a show. There's all kinds of things that we need to make that happen. But we want to give you something back when you become a supporter. And one of those, like I was just mentioning, is our supporters only show that now drops immediately with this show. So continue the fun with me and Ken as we get into some new topics, including the OSHA mandates that Jay and Mike actually agreed on. We'll see how Ken and I fall on that. So if you'd like to join us again or join our Discord channel, we had some questions from that. We would love for you to become a supporter. So how do you become a supporter? Well, you can check out more of the benefits of supporting The Politics Guys or support us by heading to our Patreon page at patreon.com/politicsguys. Or you can just go to politicsguys.com/support. Again, that's patreon.com/politicsguys. So join me and Ken, continue what this week's is by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just some random thought you'd like to share, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkinson, and Ryan Beasley. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff, and I hope you'll join us next time.